Blog Talk Radio.
The sun go down and lulls us to our sleep. Beloved who makes the earth so round about the sun to sleep. Mother who speaks her words in the silent moonlit night above.
Of Francil Gowron. You can hear more of Francil's songs at francil.com. You are with us on Blog Talk Radio, and my name is Paula Thompson, and this is The Cosmic Citizen. And with me are my dear friends and co-hosts, Crystalline Beek Larson and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We
are all
another
here.
Beautiful cold day in the deep freeze of Colorado.
Hoo-wee. It is just unbelievable. It's so cold when you go outside, your nose hairs get crisp. They feel like they're going to break off. Now that's cold.
That might be too much sharing.
Yeah. Well, that's how I define how cold it is anyway.
Well,
it's one
I
of those things
where breathing hurts my lungs. It's
yeah,
so cold.
Yeah, exactly. So we have a in honor of the month of December, and we know lots of people are thinking about Jesus. We're always thinking about him, and the Urantia book obviously has so much to say about him, past, present, and future, which is singularly unique, I think. And so we're dedicating this month to a series of studies on Jesus. And we're going to be asking some questions. And what we're thinking is the first week we're going to explore what was the purpose of Jesus' life. And then next week we'll be asking, what is the gospel of Jesus? Interesting question. You can get a different answer every time you ask somebody. And then week three, we'll look at what Jesus meant when he used the term the kingdom. So those are some interesting topics, I think, and we'll gear up for the high holy holiday to the Christian world and to all who love Jesus, which is December the 25th, Christmas. And it'll be great. It'll be great to explore this with our friends. And we've got some callers who have agreed to call in, so they're going to surprise us. We don't want to necessarily say who they are. We'll just hope they give us a call. Should be some very interesting guests. And coming up pretty soon, next month, we're going to have Congressman Mark Siljander. And Mark was a guest in 08. and he's going to be on to give us an update. He's been on quite a ride since he last appeared on the Cosmic Citizen. So we're happy to have Mark. He'll be coming in January on the 17th, I believe, or no, the 18th, sorry, Saturday the 18th. So that'll be a great show, too. Stay tuned for more information about that. And, of course, we'll always try to bring interesting and enlightening guests for our listeners. So I also want to say, you guys, that I'm touched by the passing of Nelson Mandela. I pointed out to some friends recently that, and Crystalyn was with me in this adventure, and boy, we had a great time.
Didn't we ever? 1999,
Crystalyn, in this month.
I know.
This month,
indeed.
In 1999, we traveled to South Africa for the Parliament of the World's Religions. And the keynote speaker there was Nelson Mandela. And such an amazing human being. I know that, you know, not everybody maybe thinks of Mandela as a hero, just as, you know, not everyone thought of Jesus as a hero. And Native Americans don't think of Christopher Columbus in the best of light. Now, I get it. There's two sides to every conflict, and both points of view should be considered. For me, what I love about Mandela is that he stood for what he stood for. He stood for freedom, and he stood against oppression. And, you know, people's rights and freedom, you know, obviously you give people rights and chaos can ensue. And it's like democracy. It's messy. And progress is never easy. But I think Nelson Mandela stood for progress, and he helped his people. And he was somebody who earned the respect even of his jailers. And the speech he gave at the Parliament was absolutely fantastic. It was moving beyond words. And at one point when he was speaking, a white South African stood up in the audience and he cried out, "Madiba!" And you could hear his voice ringing through the hall, this giant dome-like theater. And then he said it again, you know, "Madiba, we love you." And the whole, just a hush of silence fell over this entire place. It was packed. There was probably 10,000 people in there. And Mandela just took that praise and that love and accepted it. And I asked the woman sitting next to me, "What does Madiba mean?" And she said, "It's a term of endearment, love and respect. It's like father." So, you know, I really was caught up in the spirit of the love that South Africans and Africans in general feel for Nelson Mandela. And I'm wishing him well on his way. Madiba. Chris, and I don't know if you had wanted to add something, and Andre, but...
Well, it was just an amazing experience meeting him and hearing, being in his presence. It was an amazing and inspiring experience. The thing that I found most inspiring about him was his ability to completely let go of his personal grudges and his racial grudges, and
right.
to collectively, I mean, to show the way, to mentor the way, to show by his own behavior what it was like to forgive and to work with those who had tried to oppress him.
Right.
That was such an inspiring example.
Kind of Jesus-like, actually.
Indeed.
Yeah.
It certainly illustrates, I think, what Jesus means by loving our enemies.
Right.
And really understanding that we are all one, that we are all in the same family. And I think his spirituality was very obvious and on the surface. You know, he didn't try to hide his faith under a bushel.
You know, some of the quotes that are attributed to Nelson Mandela are part and parcel of what you see really made the man. And the quotes, you know, by the way he lived, are not just things he thought about, things coming from his head, but things that come directly from his heart. So he was all about freedom and much more, but freedom was at the bottom. And he was dedicated to that proposition for his countrymen. So
right.
He says, for to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. He was constantly, with his thinking, getting people to go to the next level with their thought,
mm-hmm.
to try to think beyond the immediate goal, that it wasn't sufficient to try to, even though he briefly advocated, you know, violence in his early younger days, only because of how violent things were getting. You know, that's an easy thing for a person to allow their emotions to get the better of them temporarily. But he changed. He clearly changed from that. He no longer advocated, you know, violence by the time he'd gotten out of prison, and he'd learned how to work with people. And so things like another quote, education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world, is mm-hmm. an indication of where he had gone in his thinking. Or, I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave mm-hmm. man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers that fear.
Mm-hmm.
And in line with the theme of our show, you can't help but hear the Jesusonian elements in his thinking. You can't help but hear the spirit of truth having touched him through all his years, all his time of reflection on Robben Island, which and collaboration. It's marvelous to hear that story, to hear that essentially what the South African apartheid government had unwittingly done in segregating these so-called terrorists altogether by themselves was they put them together in one part of Robben Island, creating a brain trust where they worked out how it was that they were going to peacefully bring about the fall of apartheid. And it's a remarkable story in evolution and how our universe works and how the supreme imbues everything, how evolutionary progress is progress is part of evolution. Let's say that. And that's what Jesus learned in his time here. It's what Mandela ultimately learned, is that if you have high principles and you are willing to put those in the center of your life and live according to them, they will guide you progressively. But you can't do that without a connection to higher spiritual forces. And it's clear that he had that. It's clear that he reflected. It's clear that he had a connection to God.
I have to read a little bit that our friend Charles Lawrence Olivier said. Our listeners may recall that Charles participated with us in a wonderful study on the angels and and he's been our guest several times. This is what he said about Mandela. And of course, Charles is a student of history and a teacher of history. He says, the universe government values actions that prevent a breakdown of civilization, sometimes much more than actions saving it. This is Mandela's context. It is my hypothesis that he prevented a race war in South Africa. It was not an unusual opinion to assume that a race war would ensue when blacks tried to gain power. Such an eventuality would have been a savage and bitter slaughter from both sides. King did the same thing here in America, in my view. Gandhi predicted in 1929 that unless a strong leader of creative nonviolence emerged among American blacks, black people would rise up. I think both King and Mandela spared their respective countries a great horror and saved many lives, guilty and innocent alike. I thought that was a very wonderful perspective. And, you know, obviously sometimes it's not easy to bring about change on this world. Change for good,
no.
Change for positive, and some things are worth dying for. And, you know, obviously wars would indicate that some things are worth killing for, too. But, you know, I don't advocate violence, and never will. I know that, interestingly, the Arantxa book says war has had social benefits, and it spells them out very clearly. But it also says that it's become socially bankrupt and extremely devastating at this point in time. So the sooner we learn to live without it, the better. I think what I love about Mandela and King and Gandhi, the three that Charles mentioned, is that they found nonviolent ways to bring about change.
Yeah.
And change is always a transition, and a transition is always chaotic, but progress ensues. So,
and they were also all willing to die for their life mission.
Right. Yes. And they did. And they all three did.
Indeed.
You know, we could say, I guess, Madiba lived and died of old age. But, you know, I guess when you live for a mission like that, you also die for it. He walked that walk. They all did. Well.
Yeah.
Farewell, Madiba.
Godspeed.
As President
yes,
Obama
indeed.
Said, he belongs to the ages now. So,
yeah.
I'm thrilled that I heard him speak and saw him. Like Crystalline said, his radiant smile, his humble demeanor. It touched me deeply.
Mm-hmm.
So we are on to our conversation about the greatest hero that ever lived on the planet. If ever there was an ambassador from the heavenly realms, an ambassador from the Heavenly Father himself, if ever there was such an ambassador, Jesus is that person. And he came here to live a life. And talking about somebody who was willing to die for the truth, willing to die for righteousness, willing to stand up for what matters. It's our Lord and Master. And having read the Arantxa book, I like to call him Master. That's what the apostles called him. And once you read it, I don't know, it just like burned, that name is burned in my heart. He's Master. When I talk to him, I call him Master. So if I say that, you'll know who I'm talking about. I think it's pretty obvious, but. And we have a couple of callers holding on already, so I'd like to go ahead and put them on. So we can launch into this, if you guys don't mind.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. I will put on, actually, we have one caller. The other one, I think, is just listening. There's no indication that they want to speak. So I'm going to put on our friend Dave Tucker. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning,
Dave.
Morning.
How's everyone
nice
doing
Nice to
this
hear
morning?
Your cheery voice.
Yeah.
Well, it's a little muted. I went to a concert a couple days ago and sang my heart out, so the voice is a little bit a little rasp.
A little rasp, huh? Well, that's a good thing. That's a happy thing to go sing your heart out, I think. You know?
Oh, yeah.
song is joyous.
And the music was, I don't know if anybody has heard of it, but I went and seen an artist called Trevor Hall. If you haven't heard of him, look him up. He'll do your soul good. And he also played with a band called Medicine for the People. And it was just it's great music. It's great music. Please look it up. You'll definitely be happy that you did.
Must
be spiritual,
huh? Is
he the one who sings Brand New Day?
Yes, that's him.
Yes. He's delightful.
Yes, most certainly. You know, I wanted to make a brief comment before you asked the question about Nelson Mandela, if I may. He was asked a couple years ago what he would like to be remembered for, and he said, "I would like to be remembered for being part of a great team."
He was that.
Yeah, I think I thought that spoke to the validity of, you know, just how precious we are to each other here.
Yes.
Yeah.
It also speaks to just how important it is, you know, or how much leaders, true leaders, understand themselves as part of a whole.
Oh, yeah.
Understand themselves as part of connection with all those around them, if they are true leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were talking last night about, Andre and I were, about the crucible in which Nelson Mandela was able to really practice his spiritual habit patterns. You know, spending 27 years alone in a cell, and when he was with others, at hard labor, and having to practice forgiving his captors from the very beginning and figuring out how they were going to fight against this oppression while they were in the most oppressed situation that you could practically imagine. And would he have been the stalwart leader he was if he had not been through that crucible? And that the team of people that he with whom he shared so many of those years were all men of really high character. And the difficulty that they've had in replacing him, I think, is perhaps because, you know, the people coming, the people following him, have hardly had that same type of experience.
You know
this whole idea of, you know, the hard, the worst affliction in the universe to never have been afflicted.
Yeah.
He certainly didn't take his affliction as a hardship, but rather as an opportunity for spiritual growth. And that was one of the things he mentioned in his speech to us at the Parliament of World Religion. That was very moving to me.
And isn't it amazing that the struggle of all humanity, in going back to Jesus and why he came, the struggle has been going on for millennia, that the same struggle, the struggle for peace, the struggle for freedom, the struggle to break free of oppression and bondage. And you know, it's quite a struggle. It's happened on every continent on this world. It happened in America. And, you know, credit goes out to...
It's still happening.
It's still happening. And it's a process. And, you know, the Urantia book calls it the long, long evolutionary struggle. And there's, you know, there's nothing easy about it. And every human being that cares comes here and contributes something to the struggle to make life better for the for future generations. And, you know, it's just truly
amen
amazing
to that.
Thing. Yeah. And we all want to do that. My friend Dave Tucker, who is a peacemaker, and Dave posts on Facebook often, and you know, blessed are the peacemakers, right? But it's never easy. And, you know, I mentioned Mark Siljander. Mark is a peacemaker. And hard is the way of the peacemaker sometimes, because the peacemaker is not going to be popular with everybody. And one thing I've learned in life is if you're going to lead, you're going to make yourself a target. If you're going to stand up for something, you'll become a target in this world, and you'll have enemies. It's just a guarantee. You know, if you're going to stand up for something.
No, the good thing, though, is I had a coach in high school that used to always quote or say the saying that iron sharpens iron, and it does. It really does. I mean, I know myself when I've started putting myself out there more to the public a few years back, and I started finding, like, wow, there's so many people that are really, really coming after me here because of it, or I felt like I was just more open to scrutiny, you know. And then, you know, it's kind of like one of those things that people that has, like, the, you know, love is my religion bumper sticker, but then goes and cuts somebody off in traffic, and then it just totally manipulates the whole, totally changes the whole dynamic of that person's intentions. But, you know, but it's through a series of falling flat on my face that I've learned to you know, deal with those with grace, those situations with grace, you know, and acceptance of both myself and others, because, you know, those people, once you start putting yourself out there to become a peacemaker or to be something outside of the norm, those people are going to look at you because you're putting your target on yourself. You're saying, you know, look at everything I do and please judge it, because I'm saying my message is to be peaceful. And the moment you're not, they will let you know. You are held accountable. You are going to be held accountable.
You have to walk the walk.
yeah, you do. You really, really do. And, you know, well,
And when you're persecuted for that walk, you know, you're in good company.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Especially with Jesus. Jesus,
well, one of
certainly
the other
understands
quotes,
that.
One of the other quotes that I really like from Nelson Mandela is that it always seems impossible until it's done. Isn't that a great quote?
So true. So true. Well, so let's talk about the struggle of humanity a bit, and why Jesus came here and what he actually came here to do. Because as far as I know, and I had said if ever there was an ambassador from the heavenly realms, it's Jesus. Many of the great humans that have lived here and done great things, we've just mentioned a few. And obviously we said goodbye to Madiba. They were born here for all intents and purposes. But Jesus is different. And there's, you know, even if we look at it from a point of view of the effect that this one man had on the world, never has a human being had such an effect on the world. I have a little document here written by a Christian, obviously. It says one solitary life. It says he was born in an obscure village. He worked in a carpenter's shop until he was 30. He then became an itinerant preacher. He never held an office. He never had a family or owned a house. He didn't go to college. He had no credentials but himself. 20 centuries have come and gone, and today he is the central figure of the human race. All the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever sailed, all the parliaments that ever sat, all the kings that ever reigned have not affected the life of man on this earth as much as that one solitary life.
Mm.
I love to think about that. People don't think about that. You know? And when you try to take that in, and you say, because what is it about him? Then, as the world measures he did not measure in any way as the world gives credit with things and accomplishments, education, like education, for instance. And yet, what this says is absolutely true. Some of the facts may be, you know, not exactly correct.
But skewed.
Yeah, you know, we know from the Urantia book, you know, more specifically the facts. But the truth of this statement is so powerful. And so, you know, we know then that there's something about this one solitary life that is transcendental of any other life that's ever been lived. What did he come for? What was he here to do? And I sent out, we put on the blurb some of his great statements about why he came. He said, often, he was pretty clear about it. And if you've read the Urantia book, you know that a lot of that purpose got perverted after he died. But I thought we could read some of his I Have Come statements and then just talk about them. So I'm going to turn it over to you guys to say, you know, what you think about this, and then we can just pick out some of those statements and explore.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of my favorite sources, I have come to seek and save those who are lost.
So how are we
what
lost?
What does he mean by those who are lost? Yeah.
Well, as someone who's never been lost myself.
I'm not lost. I just don't know where I'm going.
Right. You know, Jesus was there to illuminate a way of living that, and not just one way, but a way in the sense of how in the highest way of creative living that allows for the greatest individuality and personality to be expressed in a life without life becoming a cookie-cutter deal. How do you live your life? What are the principles by which you live your life? And the signal illumination was stay connected to the source. Stay connected to the personal source. Stay connected to the Father. The one feature of his life that is extraordinary above and beyond what anyone else's life has been before or since is that he maintained unbroken communion with the Father. You know, we hardly can know fully what that is, but that is illumination. Understanding that to live life with God, in connection with God somehow, however one conceives God to be, so long as one is constantly trying to learn the truth and improve one's perception and relationship with that God, somehow one's life improves and one's service improves and becomes more effective and more significant to the wider field of humanity as one grows, and to me that's one of the remarkable aspects of Jesus' life. And so when he came to save those who are lost, he knows how many of his children have not lived in communion with his Father, or various levels of brokenness of communion, whether it be willful brokenness or just unconsciousness, just having not understood how to remain in communion with the Father. And by illuminating that in his life, he is saving us. He's showing us what we need to do in order to get back on a path not just toward righteousness or any kind of goal that may have been talked about before, but how to truly become who we were meant to be and have happiness and success in our life in ways that really only matter to us. This business of having happiness as the world measures it or success as the world measures it was not what he was about. Mm-hmm. He was about putting us in relationship with our Father so that we would be successful in our Father's eyes and in our own, happy with our Father and with all we came in contact. And that's a very, very, that's a walk that few of us make. Mm. We fall out of that over and over because we look to other sources for that. What Jesus pointed out, and this was one of my favorite vignettes from Jesus' life. It's his talk about with Matadormus, the rich young man, and his talk with the apostles about him, and that idea that most all of us have some pet evil, the relinquishment of which is our passport to heaven. We will go for the tinsel on the tree instead of the present underneath it.
Yeah. Dave, what do you think?
You know, I think a couple of things that are very important to at least put into context is that, you know, Jesus was a human being. He did live here as a man. And of course, his, you know, divine origin, but he was here living as a human being, going through all of the daily struggles that each and every one of us has gone through and possibly can go through. And he was a living example of how to surmount that. I think in my opinion, what's even more important than that is the fact that he was the fourth epical revelation of God to man, of God reaching down and giving us example. Fourth epical. There have been many, many other revelations of God, and there continue to be daily, but the fourth epical revelation of God to man. What makes that revelation so epical? And what makes the other ones before it and the one after it epical? And I think what's important to realize is you have to put it into context. The third epical revelation was Machaventa Melchizedek. And what was his message? Faith and trust. Those are necessary for us to be able to grapple and take into consideration as part of our daily life before we're even ready to receive the fourth epical revelation. You know, we are all children of God, but it's not God's desire to see us remain as children. We have to progress spiritually. We have to grow up spiritually. We have to take all the lessons that are given to us. You know, one of the most important messages for me that Jesus, the Master, ever shared was fear not. I look at fear not as a prerequisite to being the way. You know, the Master is the way to the Father. He is the way. But in order to get to the way, we have to surmount that prerequisite of fear not. So many people come to the Father in times of angst or trouble or worry or stress, and they appeal to God to get for ease seeking. Oh Father, I'm short on my rent this month, and I really need this to come through. Can you come through for this? Or Father, I'm really suffering. So many people I know are suffering. Can you come through for this? And that is not someone who's indicative of a spirit, faith, and trust in the Father. It really isn't. That's someone who's coming to him for a specific purpose, and they haven't surmounted that fear not stage yet. And in order to get through to the way, to live the life that the Master did, we have to start with the baby food. We can't go straight from from recognition of the Father and understanding it and allow our zeal carry us all the way to adulthood, that's not going to be progressive. We need to chew, you know, baby steps and take it one step at a time. And I think that was for me, that's what I'm learning right now from the Master. And it's hard. It is hard work. It's very hard, you know. We're constantly given these lessons in life and experiences that we go through, you know. And I think, you know, there's an ability that we start to develop once we share the Master in our lives long enough, and once we're able to really discern his message, you know, and also, you know, take the messages that came before the Master, the ones that are coming after. I mean, the Arantia book is the fifth epical revelation, and out of all five revelations, this is the very first revelation that tackles everything, all of existence. All the other revelations, including the Master before the fifth epical revelation, dealt strictly with the faith of the individual. And the Arantia book does more than just the faith of the individual. It delves into the domain of philosophy. Now, in order to have a true philosophy, you have to have a living philosophy, a dynamic philosophy. And it has to have a threefold actuality basis. It's got to consist of origin, history, and destiny. If you were to have any glimmer of truth to be contained within your living philosophy, and once that's developed, it can then become a philosophy of living.
You know, what you say reminds me of Jesus saying that he was talking about when he might return, and he said, "I've come here to make a beginning of setting these things straight, but much time will be required." And, you know, we have such a circumscribed time frame that we don't realize that, you know, the universe is building on foundations. They're building us an enduring legacy of spirituality. And it starts with what you call these epical revelations and what the Arantia book calls epical revelations, for our listeners who aren't familiar with that term. I'd like to tell people there's two kinds of revelations. There's the kind that comes from the inner universe out, and it deems those to be auto-revelations. In other words, they come from within you, and we are inspired every day, and we share that with each other. That's an auto-revelation. An epical revelation, on the other hand, comes from the outer universe in. And that only happens once in an epic. That's where the word epic comes from, an epic of time. And it could be many thousands of years before we get another one, and you're right, Dave. It delineates all five that have happened, and it claims to be one of them. Pretty amazing claim. Most of us who have read it end up believing that it's exactly what it claims to be, and the fact that it gives us back the entire life and teachings of Jesus in such glorious detail is just astonishing. And we have another caller, and I'd like to put this caller on because they've been holding for a while. And Dave, stay with us here.
Oh, sure.
Area code 509, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, this is Perry.
Hi.
Best, a Canadian.
Hi, Perry.
I actually go with an American phone number because I'm in the States right now.
Oh, great.
Yeah, thank you so much for the invite, and I took you up on it.
Where are you from, Terry?
I'm from Canada, British Columbia.
British Columbia.
I've been studying the Arantia book since the late 80s, and just connected with the group here in Arizona, so it's been really exciting to be around more people where I am from. I don't get that opportunity very often. But what I wanted to do was address your question.
Yes,
why did Jesus come? And it seems to me the most clear thing, although everything that everybody said has been so right on. It's just so beautiful, and thank you. But it seems that it was to leave with us his spirit of truth. And through being able, through having this spirit of truth poured out on all flesh that is his abiding presence here, it means that each and every one of us has the capacity to resonate to truth in a way that we never did before. And how that truth manifests in each life is going to be unique and beautiful, each in its own way. But the truth is the Father's presence. And by following this truth, we reach the Father within us.
Indeed. And that experience of leaving his spirit of truth with us has, in fact, changed the world. I mean, it may be slowly changing the world, but if you look at what has happened in the last 2,000 years versus what had happened in the previous, 10,000 or 100,000 years, it was pretty dramatic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very good point, Terry. Yeah. So how do you see... You see it as something that helps to lead people to the Father, but is there any particular thing that really strikes you, that has really outworked from the very beginning? That what is it that really, what do you think was really quickened? Not a great question, but is there anything specific beyond? Quickening that inner life and getting in touch with the Father, what else are you seeing there?
I'm talking about the ability to resonate. It's like something is planted in our very substance that has the capacity to resonate. So, like you strike a bell and it rings, you strike a stone and it doesn't ring so much.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, we've been imbued with the whatever it is in our shape, in our makeup, that allows us to ring. If
that's very good.
Something strikes us, and so that whether it's a book and words, whether it's a person and their being, whether it's the beauty of the tree and the creatures around us, all these things are things that ring, that now we have the capacity to resonate to. So it's this resonance that I find is the gift, and all of it awakens us and leads us out of our fears. I thought that was a really good point, the fear not. Thank you. That was good. And all of it goes to bringing us into that state of resonance, which is communal here now with you guys. We are communing because we are resonating. And
wow.
Here is God, and here is the Word, the spirit of our master.
That's beautiful. Thank you for that. I think I will remember the image of the spirit of truth has turned me from a stone to a ringing bell.
That is a good one. That's a dandy. And it is a resonance. And we know that, I love that you brought up, Terry, the spirit of truth. Because, obviously that was clearly one of the reasons that he came. And he tried to explain to his apostles, that when he left, that gift would come and mm-hmm. how important it was. Of course, they didn't understand it, but the day that it came to them, and I think we could do a whole show just on the spirit of truth, and it would be a great show. That's another concept from the Arantia book, that it just... explores and brings into clarity, and it's throughout the book. It doesn't just show up in the life and teachings of Jesus. It's throughout the book, and they use the term that it's poured out upon all flesh, and they talk in depth about how it ministers to us all the way through the universe in our universe career. and that resonance, to be able to know the truth when we hear it. And, you know, there's a great quote from the Mother Spirit paper about the Spirit of Truth. It says that it's almost wholly limited by our knowledge of the sum and substance of the Bestowal Fund's mission. And so, you know, the better we know him...
In simpler terms?
Well, the better we know him, the better his Spirit of Truth will resonate with us. And that makes so much sense to me, because, and hence the life and teachings of Jesus, we know him so well that when we hear truth, it resonates well, because we know him so well. It's like the Arantia book says in another place, he was truth. And, you know, so he was a revelation of truth and a revelation of God's love. And because we know him well, when we hear truth, it resonates well, because we know him well. And the better we know him, the more it resonates. I always think that's a very important distinction, because I've heard people say, well, why is Jesus in the Arantia book? You know, well, we must know him well. And the better we know him, the more truth will resonate with us, because his Spirit of Truth is him. It is his personality. And something else you said, Terry, you know, that we're communing. Yes, you know, he said, When you are gathered in my name, there am I.
That's it. I think it's in Joel that it says in the Bible, that phrase, that the Spirit of Truth is poured out on all flesh. I'm just trying to look it up right now, but I think that's where it is. So it's not necessarily a concept that is really popular biblically, but it is there.
Mm-hmm.
Could you repeat that again?
I think that I'm pretty sure that it's in Joel that the phrase, the Spirit of Truth poured on all flesh, that's where it is found in the Bible. As I said, it's not really a lot in the story of Jesus in the biblical way, but it does show up in the Bible. I'm pretty sure that's where it is. I'm just thumbing through it right now.
Uh-huh.
Well, I always appreciate the Bible references. Thank you.
Well, the reason I say that is because so often I'm in discussion with people who are biblically aware but not Urantianly aware. So it's really nice to be able to have connections.
Mm-hmm. I agree. You know, we mention God's Gumshoe from time to time, and he comes on the show, and he does a Bible course on the Cosmic Citizen every Sunday, the same channel, blogtalkradio.com/Cosmic Citizen. And he shares his knowledge of the Bible. He's an ordained minister and retired now, but very good teacher of the Bible and biblical concepts, and he loves to make those comparisons and those and to show, you know, just so he feels it very strongly that a lot of Urantia book readers could greatly benefit from a greater understanding of the Bible. And again, that's one of the foundations. That's one of our religious foundations, obviously. That's part of our heritage of the Spirit.
Yeah, there it is. Even on my servants, both men and women, I will pour out my Spirit in those days. Joel 2:29.
Yeah.
I wasn't. The Bible, the people who love the Bible love Jesus. And maybe some of the ideas get a little mashed up a little, but basically, and what you were saying, Crystalline, of that by knowing him, we resonate more fully with the Spirit of Truth. And there are so many people who are biblically oriented who love Jesus.
Yeah.
And that's the way. For them, We're all together in that.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also an ability to recognize truth, beauty, and goodness that comes from that, too. It's we do recognize truth, but there's also a resonance with beauty and goodness, too, that is enhanced by knowing him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're all the parts and parcels of the facets of love.
Well, here's another I have come statement that always intrigues me and that I love dearly. Jesus said, "Mortal man cannot see the Spirit Father. Therefore, have I come into the world to show the Father to your creature eyes." Don't you just love that?
Oh. Yeah. And he's still walking with us.
Absolutely. We have another friend.
And you.
We have another friend named Angel John who posted earlier today about, you know, what Jesus meant to her and in her life. She said she wasn't well loved in her family because she was born right when her grandmother died. And in her tradition, she was blamed for killing her grandmother. It was like, your life came right when hers left, so it was like your fault.
Yeah.
And so she was really not treated well or respected by her family. And she said there was one day when she was having a particularly rough time with her parents, and she called one of the elders at her church who said, reminded her, you know, Jesus loves you even more than your parents. Jesus loves you more than any one of your family members. And so you don't need to worry if they don't love you. Jesus does. And she was just lit up with that experience of being loved by Jesus. And suddenly all of the rejection by the rest of the people in her close proximity wasn't nearly as painful, wasn't nearly as hard to bear. And I think that's a really amazing living illustration of what that can mean and what Jesus can mean in someone's life. What knowing God and being loved by God and loving God can do to transform a life.
And how real that ministry is. How real the Master's ministry to us every day of our lives, now, in this moment, is. It's not a fairy tale. It's not a fairy tale for Angel. It's real. She feels
it. It's very real.
And we all, as we all do, we feel it. It's an experience that transcends our senses, in a sense. But you know, Jesus saying, "I've come to reveal the Father to you so you can see him. Here he is." It reminds me of a story. And the reason I love this so much is when we were in Israel in 1994, we had the most amazing guide. And there was a group of us Urantia Book readers that went there because according to the Urantia Book in 1994 was actually the year 2000 because Jesus was actually born in 7 BC. And so we were celebrating this event by going to the homeland of Jesus, the place where he lived, and we did this pilgrimage, and we went to all the places he went, and oh, we so enjoyed it. And we were so blessed to get this amazing guide. He was an Arab Christian. His father dealt in biblical antiquities. He actually held the Dead Sea Scrolls in his hands. You know, he was a scholar. He would say things like, you know, theologians and scholars typically say, but I think, and this goes back to something Dave said earlier too. One day we were heading up to Mount Hermon with him. His name was Anise. And we went through Caesarea Philippi. And on the way up, we read the description from the Arantia book of this place where the headwaters of the Jordan bubble up, and well, such a beautiful place. And we read the description, and Anise got on the microphone, and he said, "That's the most beautiful description of the place we're going that I've ever heard." And when we got there, he pointed out this rock wall with niches carved out. And he said the Roman used to have statues of their gods in these various niches that are carved out of the wall. The statues are gone now, but that's what was there. And he asked us a question. He said, "What does your book say about why Jesus brought the apostles through Caesarea Philippi and up onto Mount Hermon when he gave his epic sermon on why he came?" And he asked the question, who do men say that I am? And we didn't really know. We didn't make that connection. So he said, "Well, when we get up there, I'll tell you." So we all went further on up Mount Hermon, and this beautiful place, standing on the side of this mountain. He said, "Do you want to know why I believe Jesus brought the apostles through Caesarea Philippi and up on this mountain when he asked him the question, 'Who do men say that I am?'" And Peter stood up and said, "Some men say you're crazy. Some men say you're beside yourself. Some men say, you're a prophet, the Messiah." And Jesus said, "And who do you say? But who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "You're the Son of the living God." And Jesus said to him, "No man."
Hello?
Hello?
Ginny,
hello? What happened? Did she get cut off?
Just at the crux of the story, she gets cut off.
Oh, no. I'm sure we'll have her back. Maybe she hit mute.
She got so excited that the...
Well, let's go ahead and make sure she knows
that
she's...
The radio waves couldn't even contain it. Isn't it exciting?
How can we let her know that
with
we can't hear her?
Modern technology.
Yeah. Charlie Garcia's plot.
I'm going to hang up and give her a call.
It's
all right.
Been a wonderful joy to meet you guys.
Well, likewise, Terry.
I have
thank
to
you
go
so
now
much
too.
For calling in. Could you just tell me? I lived in British Columbia for about 8 months. Whereabouts in British Columbia are you from?
I'm right in the middle between the coast and the Alberta border, right on the American border, near a place called
Midway.
Right,
I live in the Fraser Canyon myself in North Bend.
That's down on the coast, and I'm up in the interior.
Okay.
It's
all
much
right.
More, it's in the mountains, in a sort of desert valley kind of. Well, I'm up on a mountain, but yeah, that area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know
come
like the Soyuz and Kelowna and all of it.
Not far from Kelowna.
Not far from Kelowna. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, nice to make your acquaintance here.
Yes, very, very much so. And I think we'll probably be in contact again.
We look forward to having you on the show anytime.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
All right. And, folks, you're listening to The Cosmic Citizen here on Blog Talk Radio. My co-hosts are currently trying to find each other, Crystal and Larson, searching for Paula Thompson. Our show today is entitled Jesus. What was the purpose of his life? And I have on the line with me Dave Tucker. So, Dave, as we've been going along, we've been talking about various purposes of Jesus' life. And, of course, for readers of the Urantia book, we also know that there were some technical aspects to the purpose of Jesus' life. We've been talking about a lot of the things that redound to our world, how he helped our world and how he helped each of us individually on our world, but why else was he here? What were some of the other reasons that Michael of Nebadon came as Jesus of Nazareth and lived as a human being here?
Well, I mean, as it does state in the Urantia book, he did so not just for this life, not for this world, but for all the worlds in the universe, all the inhabited worlds of mortal will creatures who have the ability to comprehend the Father and can foster the desire to be like him. And, the Master was a living example of that. And, one thing that I've noticed about the Urantia book is that a majority of all the major concepts are introduced and explained in great detail within just the first five papers of the Urantia book. And those messages are just reiterated in a numerous amount of ways throughout the entire book in order for us to be able to comprehend it. I mean, because we are so adverse, we are so unique, we are so different, and then he has to come and approach us and bring this truth to us in an innumerable amount of ways. And what I love about the Master is that the lessons he shared with us and given to us that we have record of, both in the Bible and the Urantia book, a lot of the lessons are repeated more than once. And I think that really speaks to the versatility of humanity and how unique and different we are, and how he wanted to appeal to us in so many different facets and ways.
So what do you think some of those key lessons are from your standpoint? I mean, what could you dive into one of those lessons that really, really strikes your heart, one that comes up for you at this point in your life?
Service. Love is the ministry of the Father. Mercy is the ministry of the Son. And service is the ministry of the Infinite Spirit. And mm-hmm. our representative of the Infinite Spirit is the Universal Mother Spirit. And I think the Master beautifully portrayed her ministry with the service that he constantly did. In fact, more than anything else, except unless you were an intimate associate with him, you didn't get to experience the love that the apostles did, and most of us won't. But almost everyone who came in contact with him was able to receive both his mercy and or his service. And I think the Master's living example of that service has touched me in a way that, I now share with my son, and I now share with my friends and family in my life, and I make it a part of my life to serve. And, one of the most precious things to me that I ever heard the Master say was, that which you do to the least of your brethren, you do so also unto me. And I'm constantly reminded of that. When I look and see somebody doing something that I'm feeling like I'm ready to judge them for one reason or the other, I have to sit back and think to myself, I'm not here to judge. There are those that will be that. But it's certainly not me. I'm not qualified. What am I qualified for? Well, I'm qualified to be responsible for my actions. I'm qualified to be responsible for my ability. And I have an ability to serve. I have an ability to speak. And I'm blessed with many talents, I believe. And it would be a shame to allow those to go to waste. And then what I see the Master in his example that we've been given, it compels you to want to be just as good as he is.
That's wonderful. I think you make an excellent point that way. There's inspiration in the way that Jesus served, that if we really pay attention to it, we realize we want to serve just the way he did. I know that Crystalline has something she'd like to add.
Well, yes, Crystalline and I are both back on. I hope
okay.
You can hear me now.
Yes.
That was an interesting little
loud
jaunt there.
Clear.
Yeah, go ahead, Crystalline. Sorry.
Well, you had asked, you know, if it was for more than just our world. And,
yeah.
You know, did he have a greater purpose? And what I'm thinking of is just what we're informed about on the purpose of the bestowal missions in Michael's career was that he was bestowed in different likenesses, in different levels of his cosmic creatures, to be able to live life as one of his creatures, so that he could experience a fully diverse personal experience as these different types of beings that were part of his creation. And this was his final bestowal mission because we are the lowest level of spirit-born or spiritually growing human-type beings,
right.
Sentient beings. And so by living life among us, he was not only giving a revelation of God to man, but he was also living a revelation of man to God. And I think that part of the puzzle is a really important missing bit of information.
Good point.
Because it's great for us to know that, you know, the one thing that the gods don't experience is life as a growing, evolving, experiencing being in any other way.
Yeah, they can't just arrogate that experience to themselves. This is the amazing thing about deity. Deity does not presume to cheat on experience. Not that deity would, but this idea of if experience is really important, if there's something to be gained by actually going through and living something, then even God is not going to say, I'm above this, but rather say, I need to go through this too, if it's necessary for them. And to me, that's
extremely...
And
I'm
going to
go through it with you, literally.
Yeah.
Well,
and
think
you,
of this. Think of the fact that, you know, one of the things I love the most about the Urantia book is it explains the essential difference between Jesus or Michael, and many essential differences, but one of the main ones is the fact that Michael is a descending son. In other words, he starts at the center of creation. He starts in perfection, and he descends through time and space. We, on the other hand, start in imperfection, as far away from that great paradise perfect center as we can get. And we ascend through time and space. Our destiny is his origin. Our origin is his destiny.
Yeah.
He becomes then the greatest way shower of all for us. And even beings like Jesus, like Michael, who are born in perfection, benefit from experience. Experience is, as he himself said, the master teacher. And his apex of his long, long descent through time and space culminated in his life on this world. It was the equivalent of our ascent to paradise. His standing on the shores of Galilee were equivalent to us standing on the shores of paradise. It was the apex of his long descent. And his acquirement of sovereignty of his universe. He had to earn it. It wasn't just arbitrarily given to him. All Creator sons have to earn that right of sovereignty through experience, just like we have to earn our right of perfection, personality, you know, or perfection of purpose through our ascent. And so I love to think about, you know, how precious was his experience of living as a man on a material world. As precious as our standing on the shores of paradise will be to us and looking back over our long, long career of ascension. So precious was his standing on this world, being a man among men. I'm a little concerned now that I keep dropping off. Can you guys hear me?
Yes. You're still
okay.
With us.
You're still there. Until you hear a scream, you'll know that you're still on.
I got to my story about Mount Hermon, and I don't know
oh,
how
yes,
much of
you
it
knew, you do need to finish
no, we,
it because you left us hanging right on the cliff.
Okay, well, what Anise said, and I don't know if you heard the part where Jesus says to the apostles, but, you know, who do men say that I am? And Peter said, some say you're beside yourself, some say you're crazy, some say you're in league with devils, some say you're a prophet, some say you're the Messiah. And Jesus said, but who do you say that I am? And Peter said, you're the Son of the living God. And you'll recall from the story in the Urantia book, he stands up and passionately says, you're the Son of the living God. And Jesus says to him, no man will do that, but the Spirit of my Father. And he said, I believe Jesus brought the apostles up through Caesarea Philippi to see the Romans' dead gods of stone in distinction to the living God, the God that reaches out and reaches men and women where they live, as they live, and sends his living Son as an example, a representative that can hear and listen and touch and taste and smell and hug and love the living God versus
and
the
dead really
God.
That really is a powerful illustration given the context. The context is kind of everything.
Yeah. Well, he said, I believe it was a living parable, a parable that he wanted to show them the difference between the dead gods of stone and the living God. The ministry of the living God. So that was the punchline, but you know, we were all stunned by his comment. An Arab Christian.
Wow.
Took our breath away on the slopes of Mount Hermon. It was pretty special. Anyway.
Go ahead and read it. Yeah, do you want me to read just from Who Do Men Say That I Am, or do the whole of that section, Peter's Confession?
Yeah,
157.
I'm fine with it.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that.
Okay.
So this is for those of you trying to follow along. We're on paper 157, section 3, or page.
Let's station identify again.
Sure, yeah, we're on the Cosmic Citizen here. And we actually have Paula Thompson and Crystalline Beek Larson on as well.
We got kicked off.
Yes, you got kicked off. And Andre Rodatis did not get kicked off. And Dave Tucker, who did not get kicked off. So
and you guys
held
down the fort. Thank you.
Yeah, we did for just a little bit, yeah.
Yes.
So here we go with Peter's Confession. Early Tuesday morning, Jesus and the 12 apostles left Magadan Park for Caesarea Philippi, the capital of the Tetrarch Philip's domain. Caesarea Philippi was situated in a region of wondrous beauty. It nestled in a charming valley between scenic hills where the Jordan poured forth from an underground cave. The heights of Mount Hermon were in full view to the north, while from the hills just to the south, a magnificent view was had of the Upper Jordan and the Sea of Galilee. Jesus had gone to Mount Hermon in his early experience with the affairs of the kingdom. And now that he was entering upon the final epoch of his work, he desired to return to this mount of trial and triumph, where he hoped the apostles might gain a new vision of their responsibilities and acquire new strength for the trying times just ahead. As they journeyed along the way, about the time of passing south of the waters of Merom, the apostles fell to talking among themselves about their recent experiences in Phoenicia and elsewhere, and to recounting how their message had been received and how the different peoples regarded their master. As they paused for lunch, Jesus suddenly confronted the 12 with the first question he had ever addressed to them concerning himself. He asked the surprising question, "Who do men say that I am?" Jesus had spent long months in training these apostles as to the nature and character of the kingdom of heaven, and he well knew the time had come when he must begin to teach them more about his own nature and his personal relationship to the kingdom. And now, as they were seated under the mulberry trees, the master made ready to hold one of the most momentous sessions of his long association with the chosen apostles. More than half the apostles participated in answering Jesus' question. They told him that he was regarded as a prophet or as an extraordinary man by all who knew him, that even his enemies greatly feared him, accounting for his powers by the indictment that he was in league with the prince of devils. They told him that some in Judea and Samaria who had not met him personally believed he was John the Baptist risen from the dead. Peter explained that he had been at sundry times and by various persons compared with Moses, Elijah, Isaiah, and Jeremiah. When Jesus had listened to this report, he drew himself upon his feet and, looking down upon the 12, sitting about him in a semicircle, with startling emphasis he pointed to them with a sweeping gesture of his hand and asked, "But who say you that I am?" There was a moment of tense silence. The 12 never took their eyes off the master. And then Simon Peter, springing to his feet, exclaimed, "You are the deliverer, the Son of the living God." And the 11 sitting apostles arose to their feet with one accord, thereby indicating that Peter had spoken for all of them. When Jesus had beckoned them again to be seated, and while still standing before them, he said, "This has been revealed to you by my Father. The hour has come when you should know the truth about me. But for the time being, I charge you that you tell this to no man. Let us go hence." And so they resumed their journey to Caesarea Philippi, arriving late that evening and stopping at the home of Celsus, who was expecting them. The apostles slept little that night. They seemed to sense that a great event in their lives and in the work of the kingdom had transpired.
God sends his living Son on a mission of mercy and ministry and salvation and upliftment, deliverance.
Well, and then another technical reason is that, and the reason he had been up on the mount before, was that he was in effect ending the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something about which there is something in the Bible, but it isn't a very clear understanding of the impact of the rebellion on our lowly little planet. And, you know, who he was struggling with and why.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that our sister show, Symmetry of Soul, recently did a whole series on the Lucifer Rebellion. And I know there's a lot of curiosity about that. And the Arantia book has so much to say about it. So I really take to heart your comments that he did come to do that. He also came to set that straight. And as I said, as I think I quoted earlier, him saying, "I've come to make a beginning of setting this
right.
straight." He was referring to the mess created by the Lucifer Rebellion.
Yeah.
And for those who are listening and new on our for the first time on our show, a lot of the references that we're using to discuss this topic we're taking from the Urantia book, and which has a full description of the Lucifer Rebellion, along with the life and teachings of Jesus, and the whole biography of his life, not just the missing year, or not just the years that are included in the New Testament. And if anybody is interested in joining in the top or in the discussion, you can call in live at 646-716-8158. And today we're talking about, why was Jesus here? What was the purpose of his life?
So here's the reference that I've made a couple of times. This is from paper 148, Training the Evangelists at Bethesda, section 5, The Purpose of Affliction. And this was in just a couple paragraphs here from paper 148, section 5. At another of these private interviews in the garden, Nathanael asked Jesus, "Master, though I am beginning to understand why you refuse to practice healing indiscriminately, I am still at a loss to understand why the loving Father in heaven permits so many of his children on earth to suffer so many afflictions." The Master answered Nathanael, saying, "Nathanael, you and many others are thus perplexed because you do not comprehend how the natural order of this world has been so many times upset by the sinful adventures of certain rebellious traitors to the Father's will. And I have come to make a beginning of setting these things in order. But many ages will be required to restore this part of the universe to former paths and thus release the children of men from the extra burdens of sin and rebellion. The presence of evil alone is sufficient test for the ascension of man. Sin is not essential to survival." So again, there's another statement where he makes a statement about why he came, to make a beginning of setting these things right, so that men and women wouldn't be so greatly afflicted by the consequences of sin and rebellion. And it's hard for us to see that when we're in the thick of it. Many times I hear agnostics or atheists say that very question that Nathanael asked the Master. If God loves us so much, you know, what's going on down here?
Mm-hmm.
Why are things so messed up?
Yeah.
But and, then there is the most eloquent answer in the inevitabilities. And that even if we are in a sort of a war-torn universe, there is some real benefit to going through some of these things. Like, if altruism is a desirable trait, then man must be reared in a world where inequalities exist. I'm having a hard time getting my search engine to pull that up. But,
the inevitabilities.
Yeah.
Can you find it under that?
Yeah, I'm just, I can't spell it. Honestly, okay, everybody, I can't spell.
Oh,
never
okay.
have been able to spell, but
true
I did just find it.
Okay.
So if you don't mind, I'll just read through these.
Yes, please.
Sure.
The uncertainties of life and the vicissitudes of existence do not in any manner contradict the concept of the universal sovereignty of God. All evolutionary creature life is beset by certain inevitabilities. Consider the following. 1. Is courage, strength of character, desirable? Then must man be reared in an environment which necessitates grappling with hardships and reacting to disappointments. 2. Is altruism, service of one's fellows, desirable? Then must life experience provide for encountering situations of social inequality? Is hope, the grandeur of trust, desirable? Then human existence must constantly be confronted with insecurities and recurrent uncertainties. 4. Is faith, supreme assertion of human thought, desirable? Then must the mind of man find itself in that troublesome predicament where it ever knows less than it can believe. 5. Is the love of truth and the willingness to go wherever it leads desirable? Then must man grow up in a world where error is present and falsehood is possible, always possible. 6. Is idealism, the approaching concept of the divine, desirable? Then must man struggle in an environment of relative goodness and beauty, surroundings stimulative of the irrepressible reach for better things. 7. Is loyalty, devotion to the highest duty, desirable? Then must man carry on amid the possibilities of betrayal and desertion. The valor of devotion to duty consists in the implied danger of default. 8. Is unselfishness, the spirit of self-forgetfulness, desirable? Then must mortal man live face to face with the incessant clamoring of an inescapable self for recognition and honor. Man could not dynamically choose a divine life if there were no self-life to forsake. Man could never lay saving hold on righteousness if there were no potential evil to exalt and differentiate the good by contrast. 9. Is pleasure, the satisfaction of happiness, desirable? Then must man live in a world or the alternative of pain and the likelihood of suffering are ever-present experiential possibilities.
That is from paper 3. And beautiful.
Paragraph 5, section 5 in paper 3.
The attributes of God.
The link for people.
Pardon me?
And I would... He said he just posted the link on the board. I would like to assert this, that courage is desirable, that altruism is desirable, that hope is desirable, that faith is desirable, that love of truth is desirable, idealism desirable, loyalty is desirable, unselfishness is desirable, and pleasure. All are desirable. And that's why they ask us, are they desirable? Yes, they are. And they give us these values. These are values.
These are universal values.
Yes. And they say, are they desirable?
They cut
yes.
across all cultural lines and all
right.
cultural divides. And
you know,
one of the things that makes me think of this, I mean, we started the show talking about Nelson Mandela and his life. And the one of the ways he may have become so strong spiritually was being early on confronted by these inevitabilities in his own life.
Right. Dave, you've been awful quiet. Are you still with us?
Yes, I am. You know, I love how you bring up those value contents because, you know, I think a lot of the challenge for today, with not only our youth but for everybody living in these days and times, is to assimilate what is a value. What is that difference in comparison to things and meanings? You know, because those values really, a lot of times right now are just confusing for a lot of people. They don't understand. You know, we're putting things like monetary values, we're putting things that we purchase monetary or have in our lives, and we're adding value to it, and that's not true. You know, spirit value, you know, love, you know, mercy, you know, service. Those are values. Those are things that can be experienced. You know, a video game doesn't hold value. It might be valuable in the monetary sense, but it's not a value. And I think it's important that we illuminate the understanding of what those values are and what real values are.
I couldn't agree more. And Jesus, you know, obviously came to reveal those values.
Yeah.
And to give us a sense of what those values are. He lived those values. He was those values.
The master.
The master. His associates called him Master Unbidden. And you know, I especially love 8 and several, Crystal, and several of these values reminded me of Mandela. Obviously, courage, you know, strength of character, altruism, service to one's fellows, experiencing, providing, encountering situations of social inequality. There it is. He was in it. He lived it, as we all do. You know, I'm a woman, and I've lived social inequality because of it. You know, each one of us experiences that for whatever reason, you know. Maybe it's the size of our pocketbook or, you know, our belt loop, whatever. Doesn't matter. Somebody's going to think we're not up to snuff, and so we live in those situations of social inequality. But what does that draw out? That draws out a desire to be altruistic, a desire to serve our fellows somehow, to make their life better. And the one that I just really resonated with as you read them was 8, is unselfishness.
I was going to say the same thing.
The spirit of self-forgetfulness. Then must we live face-to-face with the incessant clamoring of an inescapable self for recognition and honor. Man could not dynamically choose the divine life, which is God, is completely unselfish. He bestows all that he can on all of us.
And you think about how Mandela chose to live, both after his, after his inauguration and after he left the government. He was one of the very few African leaders to willingly step down.
Mm-hmm.
After gaining power.
His humility, I think you pointed it out. We were remembering him to the list we were both on. His humility, just he exuded humility.
And he had a marvelous self-effacing sense of humor. Just a marvelous sense of humor. I think about one of the stories he told us when he was speaking to our group. And he shared, you know, a story about a little girl coming to the door and being somewhat obnoxious about it and sort of demanding to see him. She's just a little kid. And she asked him a bunch of questions about, you know, what was he famous for? Why, you know, what was so great about him? And he basically said, you know, I don't know. I can't remember. I have no idea why people say these things about me. And she said, I think maybe you are just a stupid old man. And he sat and talked with her for the morning. You know, it was like he just enjoyed the heck out of this little upstart. But his sharing this story was, the point of his sharing this story was that he was nothing special.
And yet he was, because of the very values that we just delineated, very Jesus-like values and Jesus-like traits.
And
you know,
one of the ways Jesus illustrated that same thing was when people said how great he was. He says, why do you call me great, or why do you call me
right.
good? It's the Father in heaven who is.
Right.
He was always deferring all the recognition to the Father in heaven.
Here's a great statement from Jesus about why he came. I have come into the world to put love in the place of fear, joy in the place of sorrow, confidence in the place of dread, loving service and appreciative worship in the place of slavish bondage and meaningless ceremonies.
What a great line.
He said many times, I've come to set the spiritual captives free. And I've pondered that statement so much because, you know, we talked earlier about moving out of oppression. And in some degree, we're all doing that. And in that respect, you know, our tribute to Mandela was great because that was what he was about. He also came to set some captives free. And yes, they were his people. But, you know, each one of us is here to embody some great value for somebody. And we have that gift that we can give if we so choose. And, you know, this idea of the religions of authority, sometime I'd like to do a whole show just on authorities and, you know, especially ecclesiastical authorities, but all those who would take sovereignty away from God. You know, the Urantia book says so clearly, God alone is sovereign.
And
surrender your
free will away from man.
Right. And and become the one to decide.
The spiritual captives, that's really what they're talking about.
Yeah, I do too.
Those who try to enslave the heart of man. In some ways, it's a bigger problem than any other type of physical slavery.
Oh, yeah.
Enslaving the mind or the heart of man.
Yeah.
Paul, I think someone beat you to the punch. There's already several shows about that.
Is there?
The ecclesiastical authority.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think that it's...
Well, we even duplicate our own efforts many times, so I don't think there's any problem with repeating an interesting topic.
You know, I think that free will is our greatest gift from the Heavenly Father, and, you know, the Urantia book says very early on that our choice to come to him of our own free will is the greatest gift we could give him. And being a parent, I so understand that, because the Heavenly Father is a perfect parent, and he refuses to coerce us or frighten us into obedience to his just requirements. We have to understand, and that's the essence of our faith, that his requirements are just. They are righteous. They are good. And we should want to do them. We should want to do his will. We shouldn't be frightened into it. by threats of punishment or promises of magical rewards. We should do the right thing because it's the right thing. We should want to be like God because he is good and because he is right, the epitome of what we want to be. Not because we're afraid that he's going to punish us if we don't do it. That's coercion. Or because we think we're special.
If we haven't really lived lives with role models who have illustrated for us the beauty, the truth and beauty of goodness, then it's understandable why a child might grow up without the longing to be good, without the desire to do that, without coercion. I think that we really need to take into consideration the fullness of that message. You know, the richness of that pronouncement, because it really did fly in the face of thousands and thousands of years of religious tradition. There still are people who believe that the only way anyone would ever choose to be good is if there was a serious punishment waiting as a consequence for failing to be good.
You bring up a great point, sister. So most people, at least in that particular environment or in those feeling that route, they still haven't grasped the third epical revelation of a life eternity through faith and trust alone.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense to them coming from that perspective.
And of course, Jesus showed us how to live that righteous life and why to live it that way and how powerful it could be, how ultimately powerful it is. You know, and again,
we're still finding that out. What is it then about that is so powerful? What in your experience has that been to really influence you?
I want to answer that question, but we have a couple of callers who are holding on, and we have 12 minutes left, so I'd like to get them on, and maybe one of them can jump in on this question. What is so powerful about goodness? Area code 303, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Mo.
Well, hello.
It's a familiar voice.
Our dear friend, Mr. Mo Siegel. Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen.
Thanks. I wasn't sure I'd get in. I just kind of hung on the phone for a while, but I didn't get here till 11:35. Sorry about that. I've never heard you two ladies. You're really good.
Oh, thank you. What about our friend?
Not alone. We've got Andre and
Dave Tucker.
Dave Tucker with us.
Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Hello, Mo.
Yeah.
Hey, hello.
My dear friend. So here's a question for you. Krislyn threw out a question. What is it about Jesus' goodness that is so powerful? You want to take a stab at that, or did you have something else you'd like to share?
No, I just joined you. What is it about his goodness that makes it so powerful? Well, really simple in that it's just the way it works.
Yeah.
No, I'm really serious. You think about it, you know, what makes a Lexus engine so powerful? Well, it's powerful when it works. What makes anything powerful? It's powerful if it's right. What makes his goodness so powerful? It is the way of the universe. It's that simple. It's powerful because it is the right thing. That's how I see it.
It's precise. It's well-made. It's like a well-made watch. It works well because it's right.
Yeah.
It's done right.
But isn't it interesting to think that the universe works well because the values and the design upon which it's built is truth, beauty, and goodness.
I like that point, Mo. I really like the idea of linking power with design and intention and good execution and executive ability. I think that's a wonderful point. It's like nobody necessarily gets to see how well somebody works in a really well-functioning situation, but when things start to fall apart, the good executives are sifted from the bad ones pretty quickly.
Well, and Andre, we all know that when we're not in the way of God, if we're not in the way of the goodness of Jesus that you were just talking about, when you're out of the light, if you're out of the flow, if you're out of the life's river, things don't work.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in the goodness of God, in the goodness of the Father, in the goodness of Jesus, things work. They just plain, you're happier, you're more peaceful, you're kinder, you're selfless. You have a mission in your life. You have a direction in your life. It works because that's the way the universe is. You're either with the universe or you're not.
Mm.
Or you can be in the middle, but at some point you have to choose. That's
well, and when you're in the middle, you're fraught with conflict.
So true. And Mo, gosh, I'm so glad you're on with us. This is so great. It's so great to hear your voice. Some people may not know, but the three of us and Mo study every night, every Tuesday night in Mo's home. And we study these magnificent teachings of Jesus together. And Mo, I love you and respect you so much because you so hold up the values of Jesus Christ, our Master, and you've given your life to that, and you've given your life to the epical revelation, the fifth epical revelation. You serve it in any way, in any and every way you can think to. So here, you know, it's great to have you be able to say, maybe just a testimony of what the life and teachings of Jesus has meant to you in your life.
Well, Paula, everything you said back at you, and Crystal and Andre, and I don't know if I know, whoops, I don't know if I know David, but, and Paula, I'm just chuckling because I've been downstairs in the basement going through old Good Cheer Press and Jesusonian stuff, making room for more paintings that have clogged the house and have to be taken care of. And I just got through, unfortunately, throwing away a bunch of our old stuff, but I've been in memory lane with you this morning on the years of great work we did together with the Good Cheer Press.
And Jesusonian Foundation. You're welcome. It was an honor, a privilege to work with you.
And
you said something about
tell us a little bit about your paintings. I thought you were going to say you were hanging paintings in the basement of Jesus, but because
no,
I know you just
we're making room to store them and threw away all of your receipts from the Good Cheer Press from 1993. Stuff like that.
It was
let's
about
not
time
be too
they
hasty.
Went. Yeah, you didn't have to hang on to those anymore.
Yeah, I think so. So you were saying something about, what was that about, the testimonial?
Yeah, you know, the series of shows we're doing the next two after this one today are about why Jesus came. And
what was his gospel and
what
did he mean by the kingdom? But today we're talking about what was the purpose of his coming here? And Paula had just asked, what the impact of his life has had on yours.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's pretty obvious to all of us, but for our listeners.
Well, I'll tell you, really, as clear as possible, that I think I would have fallen off a cliff, a spiritual cliff, a life cliff, if the Father in heaven and his Creator Son had not been kind enough to lead me away from that cliff. And as a boy of 14 and 15, I was reading Sartre and Marcel and Kafka and Camus and the dreary awfulness of existentialism. And ended up in a Catholic monastery school for a couple of years where I began to find God and Jesus, and then they both came into my life and completely and totally saved me, and I really mean that. And then I had a crisis in my life later on, a divorce that was, for me, broke every moral and spiritual value that I held true in my own life conduct. To have a divorce, I was so against the concept, and it just shattered me. And there was a point during that process, and I'd been a Urantia book reader for 14 years at that point, and had an active prayer life, but I just fell into the depths of despair, and Jesus just came into my life, and I mean, he saved me again, like he did when I was 19 years old. So I can point to two times in my life where I had just come to the edge of despair and hopelessness and needing to be truly saved and have him come in. And then I think on a daily basis, for all of us, and I know for me, just him in my life, the Father and God in my life, the Father in heaven, the Spirit within, Jesus leading whenever I'm open enough to listen, which is way less frequent than it ought to be. But it's just made all the difference. And I know that when I get off on the path, I can feel it in my own soul, where it's not clear and it's not happy and it's not good and it's not selfless. And then when I feel him in my life and I'm willing to follow him and listen to him and actively make that what I want out of my life, and not even, Father, it's my will to do your will, but the determination of saying, I will do your will. It makes, for me, it's just been the only thing that's made my life work. It's really simple. That clear, that simple. Because that's the way the universe works. And you're either with it or you're not. And if you're with it, it's a lot easier. And it doesn't mean we know what's right and wrong, because even if you feel that way, you go wrong lots.
Oh,
but
yeah.
At least you're in the channel. You're swimming in the right river. You may be swimming across the current or up the current or something, but you're in the current because you're trying. So thank you for asking that question.
Yeah, you're
well,
what
a wonderful way to end the program today, because we're down to the last 2 minutes. And that's really the crux of the whole matter, just what you just said, Mo. He just saves you.
And that is salvation. That's it in a nutshell. If you're with it, if you're in the flow, it has its way with you, right? It has.
And
its
when
way
you're
with
in
you.
The pits of despair, he brings you out and shows you a brighter tomorrow, gives you hope, the will to go on.
Yeah. What did he say? He said, I do not promise if you follow me, you won't get into trouble. In fact, I can most certainly say if you follow me, you will get into trouble. But I do promise that I will go with you through it all.
Yeah, and I think that's a wonderful place that we're going with these upcoming programs as well. How many of us who have found the Urantia Revelation have been saved both by an experience of Jesus and God and by how that God and Jesus have been illuminated by the teachings of the Urantia Revelation? So I'm really looking forward to what we do with that in the next couple of weeks. Thank you so much, Mo, for giving us that analogy of the river and all. That was beautiful, and sharing your experience.
Yeah, it was so great to have you. And also, area code 417, call next week and I'll get you on. I'm so glad you called, but please do call back. And Dave Tucker, thanks for calling us. It was just a delight to have you on the show. It always is. And Mo, thank you. And we'll see you on Tuesday night.
Thanks for inviting me, by the way, Crystal.
Oh, sure. You're welcome back anytime.
Absolutely.
And to our listeners,
join us next week when we ask the question, what is the gospel of Jesus?
Yeah, what
and
is it?
Goodbye for another week, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Till next
goodbye
week.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye for
You've
now.
Been listening to The Cosmic Citizen. We'll be back next week on Saturday. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.